Hello everyone and welcome back. Today is Friday, August 14th, 2009. My name is Angela Walton-Raji and this is the African Roots Podcast. Remember, you can always reach me at africanrootspodcast@gmail.com. How's everybody doing? Summer is winding down quickly. I'm just surprised at how quickly it's just flown by. I hope you're managing to keep cool. I know for many people, this gets to be a little bit uncomfortable. These are the dog days of August. It's the hottest it's probably going to be, and I hope you are managing to stay cool. Anyway, I do have a few announcements for you. Tomorrow, if you happen to be in the vicinity of Newport News, Hampton, Virginia, Portsmouth, Virginia, there's going to be an African-American genealogy presentation. This is taking place at Gosnell's Hope Park in Hampton. I think it was formerly known as the Tab Plantation. Well, this event is sponsored. It's actually a full-day event sponsored by the city of Hampton, celebrating the 390th anniversary of the arrival of the first Africans in Virginia. And this is actually to commemorate the fact that it was actually in the latter part of August in 1619 when 20 Africans came ashore at Point Comfort in Hampton, really issuing the very beginning of the African-American experience. Now, of course, these 20 individuals or so would essentially end up initiating the labor that helped to build America. This was the first generation of Africans who arrived as indentured servants primarily. And of course, we know the rest of the story. The thousands that followed would toil through years and years of bondage and servitude, and we know civil unrest, civil rights. But it is noteworthy, I think, to pay attention to the fact that the city of Hampton is pausing to take note of this event that did change the world. Well, it's a full day of activities, lectures, musical presentations, and what have you. But as genealogists, I think many of you will want to hear Professor Drew Pear, who's going to be giving in the morning an African-American genealogy presentation. Now, the events for the full day go from 10 to 3. And there are some other workshops as well. As I said, our friend and colleague Drusilla Pear is giving an African-American genealogy workshop. There is another workshop being presented on early African-American history by Dr. Robert Watson and Dr. William Wiggins. And those who have an interest in early foodways, ways of cooking and what people had to do when they lived in colonial Virginia, they will probably enjoy the presentation by John Mark. And of course, I just encourage you to go and listen to the genealogy presentation by Drew Pear. Many of us know her as Professor Drew by her wonderful blog, Find Your Folks. And also, many of us recognize her name as a regular member on the afternoon lunch chats on Afrogenius.com. But if you have an opportunity, try and make it. And I have contact information for you on the podcast website. Coming up at the end of August, there's going to be an online event. It's really for anyone, regardless of background and ethnicity, an online webinar, which is basically a seminar on the web. And regardless of your ancestors, whether they're North American, South American, European, African, there are some things that are going to be presented in this webinar online. And it's going to be presented from the perspective of utilizing the research I guess, opportunities for you that exist on the Family Search website. And many of you know that Family Search is actually the entire genealogy arm The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And this online seminar, this webinar, is going to show you how to really tap into their online and offline records, including over 100 countries. So if you have ancestors who immigrated to the Americas or came from the Caribbean into North America, and other kinds of just wonderful tips, this is something that might interest you. And particularly how to really navigate your way through the Family Search website and the Salt Lake City Family History Library. And you can do so many of these things online. There is going to be a live presentation that you'll watch right from your home on your computer. There will be a Q&A session, and there will be also some online access to the workshop that's recording after the session concludes. So it's something that I think might interest people. There is going to be a charge for this, and I have that information for you. It was going to be $49.99, which is basically $50. I understand that that price, I think, may have changed. I'm not sure exactly what it might be, but I'll have a link for you to go and take a look and to see. As I said, that webinar is going to take place. It's a one-hour event in the evening on August the 26th. So if you have some time, you might want to just check it out. I think it's going to be interesting. You've heard me mention before that this year is the 75th anniversary of the National Archives and Records Administration, NARA, as many of us know it, N-A-R-A. They're having a series of events around the country at many of the facilities, as well as in Washington, D.C., at the main building or facility of the National Archives. Well, in partnership with the National Park Service and the Carter G. Woodson Home Historic Site, there's going to be, as a part of their many celebrations, a special event on Thursday, September 10th at 7 in the evening at the McGowan Theater. And this is going to be interesting. It's going to be a discussion on the preservation in African American life and culture. The moderator will be Ida Jones, who works at Moreland Spingarn Research Center at Howard University. Ida is assistant curator of manuscripts there. And there are going to be some interesting panelists. Pero Dragbovi, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, who's a history professor at Michigan State University, will be there. Elizabeth Clark Lewis, director of the public history program at Howard, will be presenting. Talitha LaFloria, who teaches at Florida Atlantic University, she teaches African American history. And Robert Stanton, who was formerly director of NPS, the National Park Service, and Betty Collier Thomas, who is founder of the National Archives for Black Women's History at the Mary McLeod Bethune Council House. This should be an interesting lecture, and I have some information for you right on the NARA website. I think you'll find it just really exciting, and I'm really glad to see that the National Archives is including African-American history and the efforts of the National Archives to preserve so many things, documents and record sets that pertain to African-American history, and that they're including this in a special lecture and panel presentation. So put that on your calendar if you have the time. Thursday, September 10th at 7 p.m. It's going to be at the McGowan Theater, which is a beautiful theater in the National Archives facility. I want to direct your attention today to a wonderful website for those of you who have Midwestern ties. Even if you don't, I say just go and take a look. There's a wonderful website devoted to African American history, and it's part of a larger digitized or digital project that was undertaken in Ohio, and it's called Ohio Memory, which is a digitized project. And It's a fascinating website. Now, this is covering all aspects of Ohio history. It's not exclusively African American, but when you go to this digital collection site, you will just be able to type in keywords, and I did. I typed in African American, and I was very impressed with some of the things that I was able to find that came up. There were some subcategories that you could simply click on. One was abolitionists. And keep in mind, many of these digitized sites that are being undertaken by so many libraries, some of them that are state-supported, some of them are at institutions, at universities. But it's just fascinating to see what would come up. And of course, you know, Ohio has a fascinating history anyway. Well, abolitionists were a abundant in Ohio, certainly before the Civil War, and I was just very impressed with the 17 items that came up and the high resolution images, some of which were houses that were known to have been safe houses that were known to have been on the Underground Railroad, but also just some other documents and photos of these documents. The clarity was very impressive. There was a category for African American newspapers, African American Ohioans. I thought that was just really kind of neat. There were some images, photos of individuals, and some tidbits about their lives, which I think anyone who's interested in that aspect of Midwestern African American history will just kind of find it neat. And I found a few, not lots, but I did find a few historic illustrations that came out of Harper's. Many of you know the Harper's Weekly presentation that used to come on all the time, used to come out in the 19th century particularly. Some very good historic illustrations, such as the assault on Fort Wagner that the 54th Massachusetts Colored participated in the Civil War. There was another section on African American education, including institutions as well as educators, as well as people, and one on African American soldiers, which I enjoyed seeing that. One, I saw a photograph, and I tend to at least have a little bit of recognition of some documents and photographs, particularly of African American soldiers from the Civil War era, but I had never seen, and particularly because this was not a photo of the U.S. colored troops per se, this was a photograph of the 127th Ohio Volunteer Infantry, organized in Ohio, and this was a Black Civil War regiment. It was just something I'd never seen before. You see the regiment down there on the streets as they were in formation, and it was just exciting to see an image that is not very common, particularly because most Black images that are from the military in the Civil War are of the U.S. colored troops, and here's one of the Ohio Volunteer Infantry, and it was just kind of neat to see it. One, also, I didn't realize there was a unit called the Black Brigade of Ohio, and it was not a photograph of the unit, but it was a photograph of the colors, the actual banner that was affiliated with this regiment, and you know, it was a Civil War era flag with 34 stars, and I was just impressed. I had not read a lot or anything actually about the Black Brigade of Ohio, the Civil War regiment, and to see that the colors had been preserved and to get a really good high-resolution image of that was kind of exciting. One item really caught my attention was the Wilberforce University catalog, and this was a catalog which was highlighting the curriculum, the rules and regulations of Wilberforce University for the years 1859 to 1860. Look how far back we're talking, 150 years ago. And of course, this was certainly the first African-American owned and operated institution of higher learning in the country. And to see this, well, I'll call it a yearbook. It was their catalog, actually. And looking at the discipline, and it listed the names of some of the students. I was very impressed to see how many women were students in 1859 at Wilberforce. And I was just impressed. I was just really, really, really excited to see that. And I'm talking, oh gosh, every single page of this old catalog, it has been digitized, including the cover, and you realize how fragile this document is, and to be able to look at it page by page, you're really getting an up-close glimpse of one of the early historically black institutions. So definitely check that out. Take a look at that. There was another interesting item. I'm still talking about the Ohio Memory Project, the website that has these great digitized images. One was, I guess you could call it a yearbook of sorts, a Negro yearbook. It was actually a directory for the city of Columbus, Ohio. It's called, it was described as the Columbus Illustrated African American Directory. The real name of it was the Columbus Illustrated Record. There are over 140 pages of this entire directory. I really admire the individuals who locate these kinds of images and make them available for researchers. One doesn't always have to travel to see it, but you get so much information. And when I looked through the pages, I went through quite a few of the pages, and every single page is digitized, so you can just click on it and see it. And even in the front, there were some photographs of people. I know that one was a pastor and one had was an educator. It was just a really nice thing to be able to look and see what kinds of facilities, what kinds of businesses people had. It's such a wonderful glimpse into life in the 19th century. It was just really exciting to see that. And as I said, this is on a site called ohiomemory.org. And I have the link for you on the podcast website, as I always do. I enjoyed looking also at another site from indianahistory.org. And there were some interesting sites, not as many images as the Ohio site, but I was still fascinated to see that site, particularly because of a collection called the Madam C.J. Walker Collection. There were what I would consider 20 rarely seen images of not just Madam C.J. Walker. Most of us have seen the portrait. We've seen the stamp. We've, had that one image of her, which is a very lovely portrait of her. But I had never seen an image of the manufacturing company that she owned. And pictures of her school and some of the graduating classes, and also some interesting advertising images as well. And that was just something that, we all, refer to Madam C.J. Walker in passing, but how many of us have actually seen the building that she really built her income and built her empire, so to speak, from. And it was just really neat to take a look at that. As I said, that's on indianahistory.org. In addition, there is a site there, there's a link there for you called the Indianapolis Recorder, which was, I'm not familiar with it, not being from that part of the country, which was the oldest African-American newspaper in Indiana, and apparently was in operation for about 87 years, and there's some interesting images there that you can take a look at as well. So I do, want to encourage you to visit that site. And as usual, as I said, I always have a link for you on the podcast website. Well, today I wanted to just bring up something that had come up actually on a website, and it was an interesting thread that had been initiated by one of the regulars who comes to the Afrogenius chats, both in the evenings on Tuesdays, as well, pardon me, as well as on the lunchtime chats. And one was a thread started by Art Thomas, who's in Ohio, by the way. And he began an interesting thread on the importance of research, particularly how research can sometimes clarify those points that are often spoken of in family history as absolute truth, and how sometimes the story just gets flipped around. His example was an excellent one, and I'm referring to his thread where he had particularly noted that there was an ancestor in the family who had died while on a trip to visit her son. And this had been said and pretty much was believed that was the case. This particular ancestor had died while on a trip to visit her son. And in reality, it turns out that, again, this is why we need to document what we're doing at all times, and we need to connect the dots. Well, in this case, his maternal great-grandmother supposedly had died in Cleveland back in 1930 or 31. And this is pretty much said by those who knew the situation. And for some reason, the death certificate, they had a hard time locating the death certificate, and there wasn't one for her at this particular county where she was said to have died. Well, as it turned out, she had actually died not in Cleveland. She had died in another city in Ohio, in Portsmouth, Ohio, and she wasn't visiting a son. She was visiting a daughter. And it's very interesting because once he got that information, he found other items that also documented that this is where the person had passed away. There was even an obituary in one of the local publications about this ancestor who had died while visiting her daughter. And again, it's the lesson is that sometimes things that are said over and over, believed as truth, those things need to be researched. And the lesson is, don't always be so quick to embrace those items that are word of mouth and to consider them as factual. And of course, there's no reason that anyone should have, I guess, doubted that great-grandma died, you know, visiting her son in Cleveland. But if that's what is said, it's those things that should also be documented. Those things that are heard should be documented in some way. And it was just very, very interesting when Art decided to really cite those sources, and when he went on the hunt, he found something very, very different to be the case. Well, what's also exciting is that this generated some other responses from others as well. One of the responders, who's also a regular person in the chat, had talked about an ancestor who had who was a physician and who had worked at a hospital, and it was a black hospital, a colored quote-unquote hospital in Texas, in Houston. And it's interesting, when she really began to research this ancestor's history, it turned out that the ancestor died while this hospital was still being built. So this ancestor, who was a physician, could not have practiced medicine at the hospital when it was not completed until long after the death of the ancestor who was the physician. And again, these are things that we need to document and to follow up on, that are not necessarily said to mislead anyone. It's believed to be the truth. Many of us have, for example, the story in the family about the ancestor who's supposed to be Native American, who's supposed to be Indian. And the usual reason that someone gives because great-grandma had high cheekbones and long hair. And without going into an entire presentation, which I can do, as you know, on researching Native American ancestry, long hair, high cheekbones, well, there are no such thing as low cheekbones. But, you know, length of hair is not justification or it's not proof of anyone's Native American ancestry. I have an example of a line in my family that has no Native American ties, this one line in my family from southern Arkansas, and where this great-grandmother was said to have been part Indian. At the same time, some of those who claimed that she was part Indian would acknowledge that there used to be this man. He was part of the Milwee family down the road. He used to come and visit Grandma. And one of the elder cousins would kind of let her voice drop and say, you know, she would say this, Grandma said that was her brother. And she would say it very softly. And of course, I guess she would say it softly because what that meant, that this white man who would come to visit her, who was her half-brother, was indeed related to her. He was the son of the former slave master, and this was acknowledging the fact that she was probably, and she was in fact, a daughter of a woman who had been a house slave to that particular family. And at the same time, later on, same people are talking, oh my gosh, great-grandma Georgia Ann, you can look at her and tell she's part Indian. When at the same time, here was this half-brother who once in a while would stop by when she was an older lady, say hello to her, they would chat a few minutes, and it was acknowledged that he was her half-brother. For some reason, there was some comfort in labeling her racial features on an Indian ancestor that never existed. She was related to this white family. But again, perhaps it was discomfort with acknowledging what may have really have taken place in terms of the lineage. Now that's, again, sometimes how we will take a story, and not we ourselves, but we hear something that is said and it gets repeated. And granted, there's nothing to document exactly on paper who is going to be the father of someone who lived when they were a slave and they were born during the era of slavery, but how sometimes there are stories that just get told again and again when other pieces of evidence don't lead to that. Now, there is evidence to indicate that her mother was in the household of this family, which adds to a greater probability that indeed there could have been access, there could have been a blood tie. There is not any paper evidence that points out that this family had any association with Indians coming onto the land to have a relationship with women who had been enslaved. So, you know, again, I think that the point that was raised essentially that we need to learn from our research experiences. We need to study the evidence. And in the case where Art took a look at the evidence of where this ancestor died, could not find the death certificate, was said to have died, could not find the death certificate in that particular locale, but then further research indicated, it was a different situation. Yes, she died while visiting one of her children, but it was not a son that was assumed perhaps over the years, but it was actually a daughter. And these examples just continue all the time. And that's why we look for the evidence. When another person was told that this ancestor who was a physician back in the 1920s, and it was just assumed that, of course, you know, he practiced medicine at hospital, at Riverside Colored Hospital. But it turns out that he died when that hospital was being built. And again, that's why we research what we do. That's why we document our sources. And I'm going to put up for you on the podcast website some links to some good books that you may want to put in your library. When you're writing your family narrative, it's very important that you include the sources. And how do you cite them if you get a county death certificate or you find an obituary from an old newspaper that, you know, is actually supporting some of the additional evidence that you have found? How do you really go about documenting what you're finding, and how do you cite it? I will probably spend a little bit of time in a future podcast discussing genealogical proof standard, which is something that many of us need to become acquainted with. What does that mean? We're not just collecting names. We're telling a story, and we have the evidence to support the facts that we are presenting about the family history. Well, I think actually I've spent a little bit of time. I'm going to wrap it up for this week. I thank you, as I always am, very, very appreciative of your taking out the time to listen, and want to encourage you to continue to do that which you do, which is to research. Encourage you to keep documenting, and please keep sharing what you find. Bye-bye. Talk to you next week.